a very active organization. I hate to say it, but I'm going to, because I think it did do a lot for the education of a great deal of contemporary work, which we handled. And we had a women's association who were schooled to know about the various and sundry schools of art, which we tried to show all the school children that came in, and we had hundreds of them that came in every day. There were groups of kids from all over the schools in the city. At one time, I think we had 58 schools, and they got this for, first they got it for nothing, and then they paid anywhere from $25 to $50 a year to rent these things for a month so that the kids could talk about, they came and chose it themselves, and then they could talk about the art and discuss it and bring it back, get another picture every month for a period of 9 or 8 or 9 months. And this went on for years, the years that I was there. Then we got kind of small out there because the quarters were small, and the board decided that we needed a bigger facility. And they worked on that project until they were able to find a new home. But during the period that I was there, which was from the latter part of 59 till about 1978, maybe about 19 years, we started to have one-man exhibitions. We introduced young artists. We had lectures. The Women's Association brought in all kinds of things for the public. They had a series of films called Museum Without Walls, which was the first time it was ever shown here in Pittsburgh, and we showed it at Winchester Thurston. It eventually got into the museum.
The Carnegie Museum?
Mm-hmm. Here, the Museum of Art there. We were helpful with the Three Rivers Arts Festival. As a matter of fact, most of the pavilions were hung by us. We helped to collect our artists for the QED auctions. Which started, how long ago were the auctions? Maybe 10 years?
12 years ago.
We hung those preliminary shows. From all over the country, both South America and North America, with the success of the Pittsburgh Clown for Art, everyone came to find out how it was run. We sent letters off to all parts of the country. I don't know whether any of the art places started a rental gallery or a place similar to the plan, but they did ask. We had a group from China, Taiwan.
May I ask, were they more interested in the rental or the educational
service? The whole system of how do you keep an organization like this going? We have a lot of questions where we have so much art from our people, how you exhibit it, how can you get it out into the eyes of it, are you selling it, how much are you selling it for, what's your take and so forth, are you funded? We were not funded from the first day that they got their fund until we moved here across the street.
Well, what did Carnegie Mellon contribute then?
Well, Dean Rice at that time was her great white father who put his input was great. And we had people who, without being paid, the volunteer services, who did the books. Carnegie Mellon supplied the auditor. And we, as a nonprofit organization, made a considerable amount of money for them, where they were able to eventually start a fundraising campaign in 1976 or so to buy that building across the street. And I left in 1978.
When it began, you said that artists from all over the world.
Yeah.
Would send their art.
Send their slides in or pieces that they came to the United States on a trip. They brought it over. We had stuff from Switzerland, from Sweden. We had stuff from Portugal and Spain.
And there was someone who decided which, what would be accepted?
Yes, we had somebody who looked at this stuff. Originally, no, anyone could bring it. And they were looked at by a few people from the board or from Carnegie Mellon, and it wasn't satisfactory. It was returned. And what we kept was always, by contract, they were to allow us to rent it at X number of percentage per month, for which we split. And then at that time, we were only taking 20%, which everybody was. We were not in competition with anyone. We had most of the associated artists, of course. And we worked a great deal in conjunction with the Arts and Crafts Center, which it was called then. But it was a very exciting period in the art history of Pittsburgh. Very, very exciting. I believe because of its location, where in Highland Park, where families used to, and we were open on Sundays, families came with their children, and they spent the afternoon. And people learned an awful lot. Contemporary art at that time was not acceptable. And it took approximately 5 years before there was an explosion of everything was contemporary, you know. And then, of course, as the art themes changed, everybody became his own authority. They don't ask any questions anymore. But then, when they were learning, it was an extremely exciting time. Everybody knew the artists and the public.
Then the philosophy changed about which artists you would accept.
Yes. Around 1970, I believe, we decided then that this, since it had gotten too big for its bridges, we had to cut the stable again, and we reduced it to approximately 30. 30 of the best artists in the city.
Now, this is just Pittsburgh artists now.
Pittsburgh artists. And every year they would review slides of a work that was brought in by the artists. And if their work was good, they were accepted into the plan for by unit contract. And if we sold, fine. If we didn't, no one was ever asked to leave. They generally left in their own position.
Now, was it in 1970 that they started to have only Pittsburgh artists?
Art.
I see.
In 1970. The foreign artists were diminished completely after a while because it was too hard for them to get it over. So it became somewhat regional. And we kept it regional. And I think we may have had about 60 or 70 artists on that roster at that time, and we reduced it to about 30. And then from that time on, they kept reviewing artists from the city of Pittsburgh or the region, let's say within 125 miles, and they took them if their work was good. And when we got to 400, whatever it is, 347, I think the roster had been maybe 48. So they had accepted maybe 18 or 20 artists within a period of 8 years. Now, since I'm not there, I can't talk about it. But the peak years of the plan had to be within 70, about 68 to about 75.
You were the director of the Pittsburgh Plan for Art from 1955?
No. Anita Morgenstern was the first director. She came in 1955. August is when they opened their doors. And she remained until the latter part of 59, at which time I was asked to come in, which was... I got the job because she became ill on a trip. And I was the acting director from September of 60 through April, I think, of 60. And she still couldn't come back, so the job was offered to me and I took it.
And you said 69.
No, 60.
Oh, 60.
1960. Mm-hmm. You became the director of the Pittsburgh plant in 1960. That's a paid position.
Yes.
Prior to that, your works had hung in the Pittsburgh plant?
I had a few things in there, and then I took them out.
Now, when you became the director of the Pittsburgh plant, did you not put your paintings there? You did not put your paintings in there?
No. I thought it was a conflict of interest, and I did not.
Did you have your paintings exhibited anywhere during that period?
Well, I had some shows. I was at the Associated Artists. I had a show at the University of Pittsburgh, and I had one at the Carnegie Institute, and that kind of thing, which kept my name going. And since then, the same way, through the decorators and through people who wanted to see it and friends and so on and so forth. And I really never pushed it.
So it was in 1960 that you became the director?
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll hear a little bit more about your experiences as director.
They were wonderful. They really were. It was a very exciting period in my life, simply because I was, I was a realistic painter until I became so involved with contemporary art, and it was wonderful talking about it, learning about it, because I went to school to learn. A lot of the kids who were, the artists who were doing abstract work, I don't think knew the ramifications of it, so it was a teaching period, and exciting. Kids and adults, and a lot of talking. And I attended a lot of meetings. I went to Philadelphia and all that kind of jazz. But you had to go in with an open mind, and you had to be able to deal with people who thought that contemporary art was just awful, and the obscenities of it. And it was exciting. And we did. The Pittsburgh Plant for Art was very instrumental in the change of concept here. Very instrumental. And at one time, it had the best art in the city of Pittsburgh. I don't really know what they're doing now, but...
Were you instrumental in the move to the new location?
Yes. I worked with both presidents who were constantly looking for a new location, and finally, under the presidency, during the presidency of Sylvester Damianis, who was an architect and a fine artist, sculptor, we finally found this, and I was instrumental in the move.
When you say this, you mean across the street
yes.
from where we're sitting now
yes.
at 407
mm-hmm.
South Craig. And they moved there in
1978.
Said, and you left the Pittsburgh plan?
1979.
I see. And you left that because you wanted to?
I was retired.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later, Mrs. Friedman, who owns this, asked me to come in here.
I see. So this gallery where you are now is owned by?
Mrs. Ellie Friedman, and this is a profit.
And you are the director of this gallery, the Zenith Gallery. Mm-hmm. Do you have any of your works here?
No.
Your works are hard to...
No. No, I wouldn't do that to the artist. My main concern always, because I am an artist, was the artist. It was much more important that the artist get the break rather than the gallery. Of course, when you work in a nonprofit organization, it's much easier than working in one that where you have to make money. So your interests are altogether different here. I still am very concerned about the artist, but I'm also concerned about the owner, that she should be able to function, be... She didn't have his place, and the artist wouldn't have a place either. And across the street, being a nonprofit organization where they didn't have to worry about taxes, etc., it was easier to handle a group of artists whose work you enjoyed, whether they sold or not. So it's a different proposition today altogether. And I don't know how they work it across the street, but I'm sure they're still in the same quandary as we were, because it becomes very difficult to handle an artist who takes up space and you can't move him. You may like his work, but you need every gallery needs space. He never has enough.
Now you're representing, so to speak, the artists that are
now we're space. Now we represent European, New York, Pittsburgh, local, whatever we like. It's a not as easy as it was across the street. And it's a different. This is a sophisticated gallery. Gallery's really expensive art. What do you hope to sell?
Now, you mentioned talking about your career again, that you started out to be a representational artist.
Yeah, so the first time we all did. We were doing some setups. You made a setup and you did it. It's something that people could read.
And then you decided to go into...
I got excited about representational art during the 60s, when the latter part of the 40s, actually, when it was just fabulous. You know, everything was so exciting. The museum at one time had a one room for contemporary art or non-realistic art. Then all of a sudden it changed, and you didn't see any more realism. All you saw was great action painting, which was so very exciting. And that was when Gordon Washburn was the director of the museum, and the shows were just fantastic because it was a riot of color, and the internationals were beyond belief. They were so wonderful. And then, of course, like everything else, the more acquainted you become with stuff like this, the less interesting it gets, because you're so accustomed to it, and you only look now for the best. And, of course, after that big, long period of 25 years of action painting and extreme contemporary art, you got eras of 5 years where you had pop art and op art and photorealism, and you no longer could talk about what happened in the 20s and the 30s in Paris with cubism and impressionism. It's like left just disappeared. People were doing what they wanted to do. And of course, the Art Center of Paris disintegrated, and the Art Center in New York blew up, which is terrific. And you got all kinds of stuff. You had Andy Warhol, who broke the back of the, with his people, broke the back of the Museum of Modern Art in New York by saying, "You are not fair to us." They wanted to show art that was recognizable, and then it all started. Soft sculpture, hard sculpture. The last, starting about the middle of the 70s, when it all began to change, I think it all began to go downhill. I think. And of course you get this thing, it's like a circle. It starts, it gets to its peak, and then it dies, and then it starts all over again. And you begin to wonder, was it there? Then it's very interesting, because it isn't a... it isn't something that, since art began, it isn't something that's that stationary. It's always growing. There isn't anything that's new either, but it's the artist's desire to change, looking for something, experimentation, trying to find something that is basically his own. That's why this happens. They follow a style for a certain number of years and decide they could do something else, and somebody recognizes them, which then they are dependent upon a critic or a finder, a collector, whatever it is, and he makes it for a while, and somebody else comes along and does the same thing, but it doesn't change. The art world is so constituted that it has to have a benefactor. The art has to have the artist. If he doesn't have it, he sweats it out for the rest of his life. It doesn't mean that the people who have made it, the artists who have become famous, are better than anyone else. It is that they were found. There may be hundreds just as good as they are. They have never been. They work until they die, without ever being discovered. It isn't even a question. Of course, Kahnweiler used to say that you should never go where your art has to be imported. You should be there, let your art be exported.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, that leads me to a question of, how do you think the art community today compares to the art community of your early years?
Oh, it's a much bigger one. Yeah. The climate of art in Pittsburgh has grown, not changed considerably. I used to say here there are a handful, and it's true. Pittsburgh is an industrial town where the people who are working when they work are family people who take their children to out for dinner once a week or whatever, and they go to the museum, but they don't buy too much. You have a few collectors here in the city, not of great report, but there are some. You have individuals who like art and will buy what they like, but basically, to me, in a metropolitan population of a million or more, to have maybe 500 to 750 people who may do this, it's not big. Those with a lot of money will have somebody help them, and they will go to the art source or the art center, which at this point could be New York. And then why would they buy it here if they can see the artist who's producing it in New York, a greater variety, a greater amount of paintings that he can choose from, and so forth. Here, if you import a well-known artist, what can you have, 10 pictures or 5? No, he has an inventory of 20. You'd want to see all 50. You're going to spend $3,000, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for a picture. So, we're pretty strapped here. We're too close to New York and too far away from it. But the art community itself, as far as accepting what's happening, is much greater and much better than it has ever been. Just realizing how many people go to the museum on a weekend or when there is an opening, and then you can recognize how many people, what the audience has increased to in the past 25 years, then you know that whoever we were or whoever started this whole mess did help. And the Pittsburgh Plan for Art was really one of the great founders of the institution of public interest, I would think so. Not the museum, but the Pittsburgh Plan for Art.
Do you think that the schools in Pittsburgh have done much to encourage the artists of the
area?
Well,
during my tenure there, there was a great deal of effort on the art teachers, student art teachers, to instigate some of the interest into their students. They were the ones that wanted to come to the plan to see what they could see, mm-hmm. the openings to bring the children, to rent a painting. Yes, a great deal of it started during my tenure there. And I think maybe they still have that program over there. How big it is, I don't know, but we had as many as 58 to 68 schools enrolled in one.
But as far as the artists who live in Pittsburgh are concerned, do you think Carnegie Mellon had an impact on them or any of the...
Well, it's the same with any student who comes to study at a school from out of town. He will not stay here. The artist has no reason to stay here. He, who can afford it, will go to New York or to an art center where he feels that his work will be recognized and purchased. So I think a great many of the artists that are trained or schooled from Carnegie Mellon do not stay. I think it's a very transient group.
Mm-hmm. Now, the artists that live in Pittsburgh now, you say they are different, the community of artists is different socially or culturally than they were when you were first starting.
Well, I can only say that when we were so involved, it was a wonderful, terrific thing. I don't know what's happening now. I don't think they are as close socially as we were. I really don't believe that. I don't think that their reasons for being are as great either. We were a smaller group. And there were cliques, like every... Those that made it were very happy to get into a group, and those that didn't were on the fringes, and they wondered why. It was a selective. But there were... Everybody had fun. They had a huge party once a year, like a Beaux-Arts or a big dinner where they honor the critics.